So you have two separate divisions of your syndication business. One is finding deals, one is developing a database.
Welcome to the RAND CRE Show, commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hey everyone, welcome to the RAND CRE Show. I'm your host, Mike Tarvella. And today I have the honor, the privilege of having Kim Lisa Taylor on her podcast. I know she's going to tell everyone that we're her favorite client of all time, but she's a nationally recognized corporate securities attorney, speaker, and the Amazon bestseller, one of the major resources that I present to all of our investors is the How to Legally Raise Private Money, highlighting all the rules and what you need to know when it comes to raising money. She's the founder of Syndication Attorneys, and she's just a tremendous resource when it comes to the legal securities trade, and just I'm super grateful to have her on our team to help us navigate the legalities of commercial real estate. So Kim, welcome to the show. How are you on this beautiful Friday?
Fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We appreciate, you know, your time. And would love to hear some of the SEC updates. We were talking before, but we'd just love to kind of hear what's going on with the SEC. I think to your newer investor, they're terrified. To your more established investor, it's always evolving and changing, just like 2020 and beyond. So we'd love to kind of hear a quick update, if you could, regarding some of the rules and regulations you've seen change.
Yeah, so several things happened at the end of last year.
I think a lot of things happened last year.
but let's just talk. Let's just focus on this. We have time. So several things happened with the SEC last year that affect real estate syndicators and investors. And some of them were pretty good. Still waiting for some of them to take effect. And then there's some things that were proposed that may never take effect. So the one that did take effect last year in December was the updated definition of accredited investor. And so we actually wrote an article about it that said the SEC has updated this definition, but will it really help you? And it's of limited use, okay, I will say. There's a couple of new definitions that could be helpful. One is people with securities licenses can now be automatically, certain securities licenses can automatically be qualified as accredited investors. The problem with that is that if they actually have active licenses held with, you know, like Morgan Stanley or some big brokerage house, they're probably prohibited from investing with you. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there.
Yeah, it's a classic double-edged sword of you can, but you can't all at the same time.
Well, and the other thing is I always ask people, like, how many people know people with securities licenses? And there's like, you know, nobody raises their hand. So not that helpful. But the SEC, when they did it, reserved the right to add additional licenses or categories without having to go through the formal rulemaking process, which was maybe a good thing, because now they can just kind of say, oh, okay, we've adopted this new category by rule, and now we're going to allow accountants, or now we're going to allow licensed attorneys or something like that. So we're hopeful that that would happen in the future and maybe broaden that list of accredited investors. But, you know, right now we're stuck with what we have. The other thing they did is non-married couples can now qualify. They can combine their income and qualify as an accredited investor. So cohabitating couples, non-married, I think that could open up a group of people that otherwise would not have been qualified. They also clarified that you can count as an accredited investor any entity that has either as $5 million in assets or all of the investors are accredited. And this is something that people don't really know. I get a lot of questions from people that are like, well, can we like pool this group of non-accredited people together? And so they can come up with the $50,000 to invest. And, you know, then how can they qualify as an accredited investor? The thing is, they can't, unless that entity that they're going to use to make the investment has $5 million in assets. So what that means for the syndicator is that you actually have to look through their entity. So, you know, from your perspective, if you have an offering that allows $50,000 minimum investments, then a couple of people want to pull their stuff together and they're not accredited. What that means for the syndicators, you actually have to look through their entity and count those two people towards your non-accredited investor limit if you're doing a 506B offering that allows up to 35 non-accredited investors.
Awesome.
So that's something that a lot of people don't know.
With that $5 million piece, is it just a net worth or liquidity position, or could it be assets under management, or is it just assets? Not to nerd out on the accounting piece of it.
Assets that company owns. So if they've made $5 million worth of investments, that would count if they, you know, I think you'd have to maybe check with a CPA on how they would characterize that.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether they would be able to count if they had $5 million worth of assets under management. I'm not sure that that's actually what the law was intended to include. So then there was another update that's coming into effect March 14th, where the SEC looked at all these different securities exemptions, and they were kind of like little piecemeal requirements in each one. And some of them were a little bit conflicting. So they decided that they would try to, you know, kind of level playing field and make them a little bit more consistent with each other. And so one of the things they clarified in this portion of the rule that's coming into effect is that they would never integrate offerings. So integrating means considering them one and the same. If they occurred within a short period of time between the end of one and the start of another. So example, if you did a 506C offering, and just a prior to this rule, if you did 506C offering, you closed that deal and then you started another deal and it was a 506B and you only waited and you didn't wait at least 6 months between closing one and starting the other, then they would consider those offerings to be integrated, one of the same offering. So then you go do, you know, you do the 506C, which only allows verified accredited investors. Now you do 506B and you allow now non-accredited investors. Well, if they say they're all part of the same 506C offering, your second offering is actually in violation. Gotcha. So they actually clarified that and said, as long as there's a 30-day break in between one, the close of one, so stop raising money for one, start raising for the other, then you could they would not be integrated as long as you had that 30 gap. Okay, so awesome. That's a little bit helpful. Mm-hmm. There is something out there that's still a little sticky, and that is that they did not clarify whether you would be considered a broker-dealer if you do successive offerings. So we're, you know, the collective securities industry and, you know, lawyers are trying to get them to maybe some clarification on that, because it's an archaic rule that's been out there for a very long time. You're unlikely to get in trouble for that by itself. But if you were to get in trouble for fraud and connect with an offering, then they would say, oh, and by the way, you also acted as an unlicensed broker because you did successive offerings and you're not a real a securities broker. So they just feel like, you know, the original definition of a securities broker is that if you're engaged in successive offerings on behalf of others, then you're not really in the real estate business, you're in the securities business, and therefore you should be a broker, or you should be hiring a broker. So again, very little enforcement actions on that unless it's in connection with something else you do wrong, but it is something that is out there. Proposed finder's rule. There was a proposed finder's rule. This was pretty exciting, that said, you know, it's only for referring accredited investors to a deal. And there were two tiers. There was one where if you would just do it on a one-time deal, like, you know, you have an investor that says, hey, I know somebody, or two or three people, they might want to invest in the deal. You could actually pay them a commission for bringing other investors to that deal, but it was just like one time per year, only for accredited investors. Then they had another tier that said you could do it more on a larger scale, but you weren't allowed to advertise for investors. So you had to go out and create relationships with these investors, and then you would be able to get commissions and not be a licensed securities broker dealer, and it wouldn't be in violation of this rule. The problem is, so a lot of people are still excited about this. A lot of people think that happened. It was just proposed. Okay. since the past administration ended and the administration took over, we have not seen any signs that they're going to revive that as of yet. Yep. So until we know whether or not they're doing it, they had the public comment period. I actually even submitted some comments on it. So, you know, could come out with a final rule or a proposed final rule at any time, or they may not just do anything with it. So we've just got to wait and see.
The speed of the government. The speed of the government.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, write to your congressmen and senators and tell them that you'd like to see that revived. And maybe they can put some pressure on the SEC to make that happen.
Absolutely. I think there's a couple things to unpack. I think with the 506B, that's your non-accredited up to 35 investors. You can't post on social media versus the 506C accredited investors only, but you can engage on social media. So just so people who don't know those terms, just to back up. And I think the integration piece is a very interesting rule, ruling or change, because a lot of people, when they start off with 506Cs, their objective is to get broadcast this deal as much as possible, get in front of as many investors as possible. And so that with the 506B, you have to have a substantive relationship with that person. With the 506C, you can put yourself everywhere, social media, YouTube, et cetera, highlighting it. But then, like you said, now that there's a 30-day break required for the 506B. So it's good to see, you know, updating those rules and so on and so forth, so that they're modifying. But I think too, in the world of the capital raiser phenomenon, I thought that's pretty interesting that referring only accredited investors got proposed, because I feel like, obviously I'm not as well versed in it, but I think it's just interesting to see that people are getting, would be paid commissions on the accredited investors. But I think you and I have both seen the countless capital raisers who have other jobs and probably do not have their broker dealer license. I'm kind of shocked by that, but at the same time, we're the ever evolving world of real estate.
Right, right. Well, let me just clarify one thing. So you mentioned with the 506B, you can only have up to 35 non-accredited but sophisticated investors, but you can have an unlimited number of accredited investors.
Correct.
So you're not limited in the total number of investors you can have, but you can only have 35, up to 35 that are not accredited, and they have to have some level of sophistication. So that means by, you know, virtue of their education, prior investing experience, or they have an investment advisor that's willing to sign a subscription agreement on their behalf. Ways that they can rise to the level of sophistication.
Yep.
Someone more than just somebody with a job and some savings. They could have even gone through, your training programs and become sophisticated that way, so that they clearly understand the risks and merits of the offering and whether it's appropriate for them in the portfolio.
Absolutely. Yeah, because that's what the SEC does, is to protect those investors who aren't as sophisticated with it. So that's why we have all these rules in place.
That's exactly right. The SEC primarily exists to protect what they call retail investors. Those mm-hmm. are your friends, your family, your neighbors, people that you meet at conferences and other networking events, that are writing checks from their personal checking accounts or their software IRAs. They consider those to be retail investors, and that's their primary goal, is to making sure that those investors are protected.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Kim, on that piece. One thing I want to kind of discuss, because I've seen it on social media, and I'm sure you have, and it's not the political tweets or what's going on or how to prevent COVID. It's people advertising what they're doing on social media. I've seen a lot of people doing the vlog lifestyle of, hey, I'm a real estate investor. Check out, if you have any questions on this deal, let me know. Would love to kind of see the things you've seen that are okay to do versus not okay to do, and kind of some things that people need to be wary of on what they're posting. Because I think people want to do it the right way, but I think just a lot of people are ignorant to the rules and regulations of the SEC. And there's the one camp of, I'm afraid to do anything. And then there's the other camp of, I'll just run and gun and try to do it. So Providing any clarity on that piece would be, I think, super helpful to our listeners.
So I will actually share an experience that I recently had that kind of illustrates where some people are off base. Some sent me a solicitation to participate in the deal, and I clearly said in the solicitation, they sent it by email, that this is a 506B offering and we still have slots available. And I have a nice little blurb that I send to people like that saying, hey, I'm not your attorney, but perhaps I should be. And if you know, since you're not a client, then you should be talking to a securities attorney. So whether you talk to me or somebody, I don't care, but you could get in trouble for this. And they, you know, instead of like, you know, kind of heeding my advice and going and talking to somebody, they said, no, we have a pre-existing with you. And I said, no, you really don't. It, you know, because it's not just, they're like, oh, we've talked to you a bunch of times before and we've sent you stuff before. And I said, well, that's not really the definition of a substantive relationship. And at that point, I didn't want to get into a contentious argument with this person. So I just, you know, said, hey, in my mind, I said, some people can't be helped and you just have to let them get in trouble on their own. You know, anyway, so the deal is that it's not just that they met me and that they had sent me stuff. Okay, they actually had to have a conversation with me about my finances. And I assure you that nobody has ever done that. Nobody has ever asked me, Sam, are you an accredited investor? And if you're not an accredited investor, well, I can assume you're sophisticated because you're a securities attorney, but you know, nobody's ever had that conversation with me at all. So that's what you have to have. When you meet somebody, there's an article on our website that's called What Constitutes a Pre-Existing Substantive Relationship. All right. The reason that you even have to have a pre-existing substantive relationship is because if you're doing Rule 506B offerings that allow you to bring in non-accredited investors, you are not allowed to do any form of advertising or solicitation to find those investors. And so that means that in order to prove that you didn't advertise, you have to be able to demonstrate that you had a pre-existing substantive relationship with that person prior to making an investment offer to them. Pre-existing means it predated your offer. So what is that? When you're sending out LOIs, an accepted LOI, I wouldn't even count that, okay? Because you're still going to do some level of due diligence and you may decide not to do that deal. Not a current or contemplated offering. So the relationship had to predate when your offer became contemplated. So let's say you've got a signed purchase agreement and you've hired us and we're starting to work on your documents. At that point, you absolutely have a contemplated offering. Prior to hiring a securities attorney, you're still doing, you know, reviewing financials, making sure the deal would go. Then I would say, no, it's still not even contemplated at that point because it could go. So I would count it as when you've hired your securities attorney, they're working on your offering documents, setting up your companies. It's contemplated at that point. You should not be meeting new people and inviting them into that deal. Anybody you met before that, you could invite into
that. No more friends. No more. You had enough.
You cannot have any friends with that deal. So anybody that you ever meet, and I tell this little kind of story. If you get a call out of the blue from somebody who's like, hey, I just heard about your deal and I really need to get in and I've got this money that I just inherited. I got to invest it. The first thing that should go off in your mind is a little bit of, what is this?
If it's too good to be true.
Yeah, if it's a regulator testing me. So what you need to say to that person that you don't know is, I don't have anything I could offer you right now. I would need to get to know you first, and then might be able to put you into a future deal. So always meeting people today for future deals. If you've already got a deal in place right now, you're raising money for it, don't put that person in your deal if they call you out of the blue. Now, what if somebody introduced that person to you? One of your other investors said, hey, I know a guy, he'd like to invest with you. That might be okay because you didn't find them through general advertising or solicitation. And remember, that's why you had to prove this relationship. But you still better understand their finances before you invite them to invest with you. So that's the substantive part. Substantive means that you have to have a conversation with that investor about their financial condition. Are they accredited? Are they not accredited? If they're not accredited, how are they sophisticated? What What's their education? What's their investing background? What's their financial history? Are they interested in being in a deal for the next 5 to 7 years, if that's what you're proposing? And, you know, how much are they looking to invest? Is it something that they could afford to lose if something went horribly wrong? You know, so you really need to vet your investors, and you need to have a record keeping system that you can take notes about that conversation and when you had that conversation, who it was with, what was discussed, and what the answers were. Then after that, now you're going to mark them in your database as either an accredited investor or a sophisticated investor, or not accredited, and then you're not going to solicit them anymore. All right. But if they're sophisticated, at least from that point on, you can tell them about your deals. So you could send them emails about your deals. I still caution people not to do email blasts to multiple, you know, a large database of people. Actually knew somebody that got in trouble with the SEC, and they had sent out an email blast to 200 people. And the SEC said, you generally solicited. And they said, oh, we had pre-existing relationships with all those people. And the SEC said, that's a general solicitation. Okay. When you're dealing with family and friends, okay, best not to deal with them in 200, probably better to deal with them one-on-one. Also going to be much more effective for you to solicit people to invest in your deal that way. If you call your friend and say, hey, we've been talking for a while and I told you I was looking for deals. Now I've finally got one. You've already had that substantive relationship conversation with them. You've established that. Now you can say, Are you interested? Can I send over the property package and let you take a look at it? And then I'll send that today. And then I'll give you a call in a couple of days, see if you have any questions. That is going to be your most effective method of getting an investor engaged and wanting to invest in that particular deal. And even if you're doing a 506C offering that allows you to advertise, if you take those exact same steps every single time, but far just sending out an email blast and seeing what percentage comes back.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point to do it is you don't want to feel like a 1% cold calling campaign to money raise. You should have kind of your core group of, I can present this deal to these people and feel good that they're probably going to accept because of relationship, alignment of goals, because I'm going to caveat this as like not legal advice, but you taking their money is being ethical, and you have to be a fiduciary, and you have to align on core values, right? I think if someone wants to be in the deal for 2 years and you're having 5 to 7 years, you shouldn't take their money, because then it's just you're going to hinder that relationship, and it's not very ethical. And I think two, the ability to lose money. I've had investor calls where like, I love Jake, Gino, and everything they do. I have the last 50,000. Here you go. And I write in my notes, we'll never take their money unless it's years later, right? Because it is an investment. It is a risk. No one likes to talk about the potential downsides, but you have to protect their investors' money. And it is an investment. There's the risk of losing it. So I think it's when you are raising money, and I think it's being, you know, when everything's going up, it's easy to continue to raise and prove that track record, but make sure you know them, make sure you like them, make sure you trust them, and prove it out. And like you said, it takes a lot of work to build those relationships, but it's also just important to realize, you know, you have to know, like, and trust the LPs on that side too, because it shouldn't feel like a cold call marketing. Us, we thankfully have 100 active investors on our roster that we've talked to and done deals with and have worked with. But for those starting off, you should really have a core group as you continue to expand and keep those leads warm and document like crazy. I got that from my background of being a CPA. That's boring. It's not sexy, but neither is getting sued by the SEC. So it's making sure you have those systems in place to continue to grow and grow your investor bases ethically.
That's right. Yeah, and the whole thing is you're creating a defensible relationship. And, you know, think of these securities exemptions, Rule 506B or Rule 506C. These are the federal securities exemptions that allow you to raise money from people in any state and only follow one federal set of rules. If you follow the rules in everything that you do and you document the heck out of it, then if an investor ever complains to, and they're likely to complain to their state securities agency, because the federal securities agency, near as I can tell, I don't go after anybody until they stole about $15 million. Okay, but your state agencies will go after people that have issued promissory notes to investors in their state without following exemption. I've seen that happen. You know, they don't care. They'll follow up on one single complaint. So you've got to make sure that you're following the federal rules and you're doing it in a way that's going to be compliant with those state laws. And if you do that, then when those state regulators come to you, they ask you for documentation to show, well, show me how you followed the Reg D Rule 506B exemption. And you're going to have to produce that documentation. If you can produce it, and hopefully you have boxes of things to send to them. If you do, then you're not going to get in trouble. If it's the people that say, what's a 506B exemption? Those are the people that get in trouble. You know, it's like a tax deduction. If you claim the tax deduction, you're entitled to take it. It's a self-executing deduction. But if you're ever questioned about it, you better be able to back up or they're going to take it away from you. Securities exemptions are the same way.
Exactly. And I think that's a great point, right? Defensible relationship. For those out there who are like, oh no, I could be doing a better job documenting. I don't have the perfect system, kind of like my taxes. I'm claiming it, but probably don't have the most, ironclad defense. What would you recommend to those listeners who are kind of scared right now and need your guidance? How would you recommend kind of next steps for them in building that defense to prove out that relationship?
So, read some of the articles on our website, read my book, make sure that you have an understanding of that. We offer free initial consultations if somebody wants to ask us some questions. We have a low-cost way that people can engage with us so we can review their processes, review their marketing materials, make sure that what they're doing is correct, and provide the correct disclaimers. We're happy to engage with you if you want to have that one-on-one relationship with us. And we do it in a way that you'll even get, a discount later off from any syndications or anything like that you plan to do. Even for passive investors, it's not a deal that we've written, that our firm has written. We can review other people's deals so that they seem to be complying with securities laws. And we've done that in the past. But it's really just, making sure that you get knowledgeable about what the exemptions mean and, understanding what those requirements are and being able to spot whether, you're following those or, if you're a passive investor, whether the people you're thinking about investing with are following those rules.
Absolutely. And like every other real estate cliche, it's building that all-star dream team to help you learn, grow. We've talked to Kim countless times of ticks and formations and, what's the right way to do it. So just because it's someone else's deal, don't necessarily assume they're doing it. Always, have that free consultation with Kim because you always want to protect yourself. And Kim has been super helpful to our Jake and Gino community. When building your team, please leverage Kim. She's a phenomenal resource. And I'm not just saying that. She, I've showed people her book. If people are, I see that post that's questionable, I'm like, talk to Kim Taylor. She's just a tremendous resource. I can't stress that enough. And having the legalities behind you and knowing you're doing it right gives you that much more confidence to execute, because it's hard enough to do deals. It's hard enough to raise the money. It's hard enough to do everything. The last thing I know is I did the legalities wrong and the deal is just in turmoil. So
You don't want that. It's not good for you. It's not good for your investors. The worst case scenario is you can't defend something that you did because you made a misstep. If it's just a technical misstep and you really tried to comply, the SEC or any state regulator has the ability to just overlook that. But if you made no attempt, that's when you're going to be in trouble, or you don't have any documentation at all, or you don't even know what exemption is, or what an exemption is, or what they're talking about. You really got to now.
It's being negligent.
It's money. Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, starting with coach, you know, the Jake and Gino coaches, you know, all of our clients that have done multiple deals have started with a coach for their first several deals, and, you know, getting them to that first deal and the maybe the second, third deals, they've always stayed in that coaching program, and they're the ones that have gone on and done bigger and better deals or more deals. You know, it's building that foundation and gaining that confidence. That's hugely important.
Yeah. And it's the confidence in shortening the learning curve. I think, and any true success is that ability to shorten the learning curve and just learn and grow. Michael Jordan probably couldn't have done it without Phil Jackson. I mean, there's countless of, you need someone higher above you who's seen it before to help you look out above the trees and see what you've been. So invest in your mentorship, whether it's Jake and Gino, whether it's, you know, someone who's done it before, not to plug, but that's the only way you can learn and grow fast and protect your blind spots, because everyone in real estate lately has been talking about all the upside, but looking at, you know, mentors like the Ray Dalios and the Sam Zells and the Howard Markses, you have to minimize your downside risk as much as possible. So don't botch it on the front end with the legalities. And like you said, don't be negligent. Having those mentors will do that for you.
Well, and make sure you know who your partners are and pay attention to what they do. Okay. Because a bad partner can, you know, mishandle funds, can not bother to learn about securities laws and go out and, you know, if they're out there doing the wrong thing, even though you learned everything, if you're part of that management team, you could still be held responsible for that. And beware of your investors that get super exuberant about your deals, because they could go out and do something that's general solicitation that could actually cause you to lose your exemption. So you've just, if people say, hey, can I bring some other investors to the deal? You want to have a very clear conversation with them about how they're going to talk to those people. Make sure they're not posting stuff on their own social media platforms that is going to ruin your deal.
And that, I think too, the power of saying no, or the power of like, yes, but, and educating those investors, I think will 10X, 100X that trust factor of, I just met you and I want you to invest in this deal because whatever reason. But I think saying no will just create much more respect amongst the investing community and just really help you long-term. I think everyone's been eager to get deals. Us ourselves are looking to expand this year and continue to grow, but we want to grow responsibly. So we've had to tell investors, no, it's not a substantive relationship or whatever the reason may be. But I think when you say no to money, you know, to investors, it's hard. When you're first starting off, you're like, how am I going to tell someone no? But you'll gain that trust and credibility that you're doing the right thing, and people will respect you in the community, in the investing world, even more.
Absolutely. Yeah. You, just because someone has money doesn't mean you should take it. You know, there's a lot of reasons that they may not be compatible with you. It could just be personality. It could be, cultural, or just, you don't like them. Don't bring people into your life and into your world that you don't want to spend the next 5 to 7 years with, or that you don't want to be intimately involved with if something starts to go horribly wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a huge piece. I treat every partnership like a marriage, because you're saying I do for a long period of time. And I too get weary when the taking calls with investors and they go, well, is there an out clause, or if something happens, what can I do? Because then it's like, hey, we want to grow this together, but I can't have you half committed on the front end, right? So and I tell our investors, it's a 5 to 7 year commitment we're looking at. We generally like to, hold these assets longer than the 2 to 3 year period. So if you're not dedicated to that time period, it might not fit, and that's okay. I mean, I've had investors who want to buy apartments with just cash. There's nothing wrong with, but it's just fundamental different in thesis, and that's okay. And I still want to help that investor, whether it's finding a new sponsor or just getting them to know the area. it's just impact. And the more impact you have in educating investors, the longer you'll go in the space. And I think you, Kim, and Jake Cinziano and Gina Barbaro are true, you know, educators in the space and want to help as many people as possible. And that's where their successes truly come from.
That's very, very much true. You know, yeah. You've got to spread goodwill to get it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, one other thing I would say is, you know, just thinking of like some of the biggest mistakes that newer investors or newer syndicators make, you know, don't wait for investors. If somebody says, oh, I'm going to invest 400,000, but I got to do this other deal or this or that, or, you know, something else has to happen. Don't wait for that investor. Just tell them, you know, it's first come, first serve. We'd love to have you invest with us, but we're getting subscribed. You know, let us know when you've got your funds together and we'll let you know if we still have any opportunities left. You know, I actually saw somebody a couple months ago that waited for a $400,000 investor and lost the deal the day before closing. And, you know, they probably had $50,000 or $60,000 or more invested in that deal that, you know, that they don't get back. So you can't wait. You just have to keep raising money. You also have to be careful of, you know, it's a rookie mistake to think you're going to, you know, I don't want to find a bunch of investors. I don't want to make relationships with a bunch of people. I'm just going to go find one or two people. That hardly ever works out. You know, 85% of the time doesn't happen. These investors, you know, you're going to be talking to family offices and institutional investors. And what they're really thinking in the back of their mind is there's no way I'm investing in this person. They have no experience. And, but I'm too polite to say no. So I'm going to tell them all the things we look for in a deal, and they're going to try to achieve that and keep thinking that I'm still interested when I'm really not. And eventually they either go dark on you or they change the terms and say, well, you know, if you wanted to do a 90-10 split and then we'll take you out after the first year, it's not your deal anymore. It's their deal. And you just bought yourself a new job. So I don't know how many, you know, all the clients that I have are trying to get out of their old jobs. They're not trying to buy a new boss. So just, you know, beware of bringing in one boss. If you end up with, you know, 10 or 15 investors, you're going to have much more control over the deal, and you and they will be much happier.
Yeah. And that, I didn't realize until coming to Tennessee that what you described is the Midwestern no. We say yes the whole time until we go dark. I didn't know that was a thing until coming down to Tennessee. So someone on the sales team mentioned that. I was like, oh, I do that. And so it's funny you say that. And I think too, it's important. No, that's that urgency when you have a deal, because 60 days to do due diligence, do the investing raise, educate your investors on it, talk to them, help them guide their funds in, because it's herding cats. We love all the cats that we herd in, but it can be hard of there's so many nuances of retirement funds and this and that. So it's just making sure everyone's in, everyone's compliant. And I think never wait. You can never raise enough money in a world of infinite capital. Is it a lot of hard work? Yes. But if you are deeming it as work, maybe stick to the passive side where you have no, you're the boss to the GP. And that's okay. So I think a ton of value when it comes to that gut check and helping the investors as they continue to learn and grow.
That's right. That's right. No one's an investor until their funds are in your bank account. Until no. Then you're just having a conversation.
That's like a deal under contract, right? You got the LOI accepted and you're excited. You post it on Facebook and then it's like 5 months later, it's like, hey, didn't they have a deal under contract? So even I see those posts and I'm like, it's only just begun, my friend. Yeah, I know you're excited because it's the first one, but.
Well, the other thing is from a legal standpoint, I tell people don't ever tell anybody about your deal, even anything about it. Don't say it's 14 units in Mississippi or anything like that, because somebody else will find it. So until you have a signed purchase agreement, you don't have a defensible contract. And, you know, even an LOI, it doesn't matter if it says it's legally binding. It's only as legally binding as your ability to file a lawsuit and enforce it. And in, you know, you're never going to do that. You're just going to go on and go next. But if you post that deal somewhere, somebody else may figure it out and they could go in and offer, you know, $10,000 more and get that deal.
Yeah, literally, I laugh because I have an LOI on our desk and it literally, like, we're working on the template. So this is not a solicitation, I promise. It says this is not intending to be a binding agreement. This is just the bridge to get to the PSA. So I don't even like posting, I don't post on social media of anything about due diligence or anything. We're just going on site tours and just those field trips alone so that no one knows, that everyone knows it's not an offering, because even brokers laugh at me. They're like, are you in the office today, Mike? Wow, that never happens with you. I'm always in the car. So, you know, make sure it's not an offering. And I think that's super helpful.
Well, and I also tell people, don't talk about your deal parameters and what you're offering investors until you've hired your securities attorney and you've had your deal structure and conference with them. Because if we look at what you're doing and say, you shouldn't do it that way, or there's a way better way for you to do that, you're locked in. At that point, you can't change. And you may be stuck in a deal that you will end up regretting because you didn't have the right advice before you started locking in terms with your investors.
Exactly. And even when I talk to investors, I mentioned historically, right? Because deals we bought 2 years ago are much different than the criteria of today. Right.
That's so, right.
You know, I treat it as like a case study of like, here's what we've done, but you know, buying, you know, the 20 IRR deal that was 3-4 years ago, well, looks much different now. And, with everything going on, it's a whole new world. So I think it's just important to, you know, as a CPA and a lawyer on this call, it always depends. And so always ask the questions up front before you market or advertise anything.
That's right. That's right. And make sure you have the right disclaimers, because you don't want to go advertising a real 506B offering and email blasting it out to people. And make sure that there's no securities attorneys on your list.
Went full circle with the Facebook blast. That's awesome, Kim. But Kim, I want to make sure I'm respectful of your time, but would love to hear your one investor pro tip for our listeners to help them in their real estate journey.
Build an investor marketing program. Okay, so you have two separate divisions of your syndication business. One is finding deals. One is developing a database of pre-vetted investors. And a lot of people spend most of their time on the deal and learning with their coaches how to find the deals. Then they don't spend enough time building that database. The SEC says that the median raise is $2 million with 14 investors. And that's for a Rule 506 offering. So, you know, the rule of thumb from all the real estate coaches that I've listened to has been, you're going to have 2 to 3 times that many people that commit to your deal, which means you probably have to have 5 or 6 times that many people in your database that you can contact, because a lot of them are just going to say, no, I can't do it right now, or I'm not interested. And then you've got to whittle that down to 2 or 3 times how many you need. So, you know, if you're raising $2 million, you better have 30 or 40 investors that are saying yes. And then you start collecting the funds, and you know, you're going to end up with the right amount that you need. The other thing I would say is, if you get a deal and you're still raising money after you close on the deal, do not take your foot off the gas. Continue raising money as diligently as before until you hit your target. Because if you don't, then you're going to end up with the same property that the last people had, and you're not going to be able to do the improvements that you want to do or need to do to make it profitable.
Yeah. And plus too, with that rolling close, it's a very difficult model, because I think a lot of investors see we're closing on this date. And now you have to educate a lot of the investors of, no, no, we closed on it, but we need more money to do X, Y, and Z. And that's why. So, you know, the education, I think that's a you know, like you said, with the drip, the investor funnel, it's like deal funnels, right? It takes 80 to 100, you know, underwritings to come up with one deal, right? Because then you have to write, you know, that many offers, only 10% get accepted, and so on and so forth. So treat the investor funnel just as serious as the operation funnel, and never let your foot off the gas when it comes to fundraising.
Until you've got every last dollar in the bank that we set out to raise.
Exactly. And also, she didn't say it, but I'm going to say it for you. Buy the book to all your investors, like everyone on this podcast listening. and schedule a call with Kim. She is, like I said, an amazing resource, and we really value her on our team. And if you don't have a securities lawyer on your team, I would highly recommend Kim, and just, you know, follow her, you know, her website and her resources and articles. What's that?
We have a new podcast.
What's the podcast?
Raise Private Money Legally for Real Estate.
Perfect. So follow us, subscribe to the podcast today. Don't wait. Cause you know, it's like I said, Kim's a great resource. So if you have any questions for Kim, Kim, where can they find you besides the podcast?
So I wanted to say that you can get the book for free. And if you want a digital copy of the book, you can get it free and download it continuously at syndicationattorneys.com. And there's a tab there that says get the book, or you can buy it on Amazon. But while you're at the website at syndicationattorneys.com, there's a button there where you can schedule an appointment, and we can talk to you about the various programs and offers that we have, and just kind of help guide you on your steps to starting to build that investor database. We also have an affiliate website at investormarketingmaterials.com. So if you don't have deals yet and you're starting to develop those relationships with investors, you need some professionally edited and designed marketing materials, you know, to make yourself look good, describe your business model and pitch decks, all that kind of stuff. We can help you with that.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Kim. And like I said to everyone, please reach out to Kim. She'll make you feel much more confident and know that you're going the right direction. And if anyone has questions for us, please reach out to us at info@randcre.com. And until then, we will see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.